Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today we're going to look at the act of class-based persecution in the Soviet Union during the Stalin era. Suffering that kulaks and former people who were those who had been part of the middle classes or the aristocracy during the Tsarist era, the suffering that they were subjected to as a result of having bad social or illegal social backgrounds or origins. Now, in these previous podcasts, one of the things we've looked at is the idea of the new Soviet man and woman, the idea that the individual could be reforged through labour, and that working for the collective, working for building of socialism, was the kind of thing that would change the mind, change the body, and kind of change the soul, almost, and create sort of idealized forms of human beings. And I've previously mentioned one of the kind of the manifestations of this with the sculptures of Vera Mokina. The most famous were those that sat upon the top of the Soviet pavilion at the Paris Expo of 1937, Proletarian Man and Kolkhoz Woman, which are these chiselled and heroic workers and peasants charging into the future, into the bright optimistic future that Stalinist planning was going to bring. So, on the other side of things, there were those who were considered to be irredeemable. There were people who were sent to labour camps or sent to complete forced work as members of the criminal classes, you know, thieves and burglars and robbers and bandits and things like that, who were transformable, it was seen by the state, but people with bad class origins or the people from the wrong kinds of social classes were seen as a problem that could never really, really be eliminated. Why? Well, you have to kind of delve into kind of Bolshevik psychology here, or the version of thinking that the Bolsheviks imagined was true, or that people possessed. The idea that externally an individual could say all the right things, could turn up to work and act as a good proletarian, could recite Karl Marx or do everything, but internally they would not have changed. Internally they would be keeping secrets. Externally they would be putting up a facade. Stalin often talked about people wearing masks and what is behind the mask. This is partly to do with Stalinist paranoia, and it's partly to do with the belief that even though there had been a revolution, even though there was a new social state of affairs, that there would always be those counter-revolutionaries, those people who hung on to the past, those people unwilling to leave, to let the past go, who would maintain themselves as a constant problem. Partly this was the kind of the Marxist-Leninist, or the Leninist reading of Marx, in that any revolution, once it had happened, would have to go through a long period of vigilance because there would be counter-revolutionaries. This is where the idea of the kind of the dictatorship of the proletariat comes from, that there would be counter-revolutionaries willing to drench the country in blood in order to get back into power. The experience of the Civil War pretty much showed the Bolsheviks that this was the case. One needs only to look at any socialist revolution around the world in the 20th century and look at the rapidly following counter-revolution that tends to greet it, to recognise that there is something to be said for the fact that any socialist revolution is most likely to face stiff opposition and an attempt to undo it as quickly as possible. So the answer, so it was put forward by Marx, was a dictatorship of the proletariat, a period of time in which workers would be in charge and only parties that represented workers would be in charge. Marx doesn't really kind of delve into the more blood-soaked aspects of this, and there's nothing in Marx that really suggests that the practices of Stalinism were what were intended. But it's the consequences that we're chiefly interested in. So, again, we're looking at Sheila Fitzpatrick today. We're looking at Chapter 5 of Everyday Stalinism. And we're looking at how the former people were treated. She writes, "Soviet society had many outcasts. In the 1920s, they included priests, former priests, members of the pre-revolutionary nobility, former capitalists and NEP men, the black marketeers of the NEP era, kulaks and persons who'd been de-kulakized. Most of these people were formally stigmatized by being deprived of the vote. In the 1930s, the ranks of outcasts were joined by a growing population of administrative exiles and political prisoners. The families of all these people usually shared in their stigmatization. Wives, children, and aged parents were deported, along with kulaks. Priests' sons and daughters were denied access to higher education. During the Great Purges, there were special camps for wives of traitors to the motherland." Now, the purges are important in this because the process of this stigmatization, of the removal of rights, of the earmarking names of suspicious people from the late 20s onwards, this doesn't automatically involve the execution of those individuals. But later on, when the Great Terror begins in 1936, what happens is that the NKVD are able to look back through the archives. They are able to go to provincial cities and towns and check records of who is considered to be a former person, who is considered to be an enemy class, and they are the first to be executed. One interesting point that Sheila Fitzpatrick raises is that the tendency to stigmatise, to look for enemies, to look for traitors, to be suspicious of others and to outcast others, was not just a political tendency by the regime, but had become deeply rooted within Soviet society. It had become like part of the operating logic of Soviet citizens. When there is a revolutionary government more than willing to use extreme violence, when there are food shortages and shortages of accommodation, and the omnipresent narrative that there are dangers and threats all around, and that dangerous enemies are always up to no good, wanting to derail the future and prevent Soviet society from reaching the promised land of socialism, then amongst individuals there's going to be this tendency towards denouncing. And when people are arrested or sent away into exile or sent to camps, then there is also a narrative of this being justified and explainable and, to some extent, desirable. That if it wasn't for the fact that these were bad people, then this might be unfortunate, but these bad people are going to do something bad and they're getting what they deserve. And there was also a spirit of the confessional and the recantation in the Soviet Union. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "Communists who strayed into opposition were often required to make public confessions and recantations of their mistakes. But confession did not absolve them. Sometimes repentant oppositionists were allowed back into the party, but their status thereafter was precarious, and most were expelled once again after a few years. Similarly, undesirable social origins could not be cast off by statements of loyalty or repudiation of one's class or parents. Priests, to be sure, were sometimes encouraged by local officials to renounce the cloth in a dramatic public gesture, but since they were rarely able to find other employment unless they hid their past, in practice the stigma remained." The culture of denunciation. There's quite a few memoirs of people from enemy classes growing up in the Soviet Union who became deeply angry at their parents because of their parents' class origins. And their parents' life before the revolution meant that these young people growing up were not able to join in or participate in Soviet life. There's some really interesting stuff written in by The Whisperers by Orlando Figes, in which he writes about the emotional pain that some young Soviet people went through when they were excluded from institutions like the Young Pioneers or the Komsomol. These organisations aren't really analogous to Western youth organisations particularly. The Komsomol was something greater than our ideas of, say, scouting or the cadets in Britain or the USA or Western countries. The Komsomol was a youth organisation that was also part of the kind of the idea of rebuilding or building the future, participating in the creation of socialism in Russia. And to be excluded from that when all one's peers are kind of fully engaged in it, and fully engaged in the active participation of a grand historical project, it's easy to see how that would be a very, very painful experience. In addition to that, there were those who were who were able to obtain forged documents or who were able to move around sufficiently that they could shake off their class origins. But these were periodically exposed when bureaucrats did some digging and found out that all was not as it appeared. So those who had managed to evade their class origins lived in constant panic and fear, long after the Stalin era, that they might be exposed. Now here we kind of delve into the realm of sociology and social psychology, and we don't want to kind of go in there too far, because it's stuff that probably there are other people that know an awful lot better than me.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
But it's interesting to consider what happens to the makeup, the ideas, the discourses within an entire society when the experience of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps even more, are those of shame, stigma, anxiety, fear, and being excluded from the direction of society, excluded from what society, in the broadest political ideological senses in the Soviet Union during the Stalin era, is supposedly all about. And perhaps this is has had some effect on shaping Russian outlooks and sensibilities in the 20th and into the 21st century. It was necessary to resort to the black market, to go via illegal methods, because social stigmas were so so rigid, so difficult to remove, virtually impossible, and would be this sort of secret identities had to be created. And this is very, very common. The penalties for actually being revealed as somebody who had hidden their class origins are extreme. Long spells in the gulag and perhaps even execution. And that would more than likely have happened during the period of the terror. Unmasking enemies is the duty of every loyal party member, and the duty of also of the Komsomol. So young Komsomol members were very vigilant in trying to find the hidden class enemies. And this all fed back into the narrative that there were dangerous subversives hidden amongst us who were going to cause all manner of chaos within society and derail the process of socialist construction. But it wasn't just for political and ideological reasons that people denounced one another. Because of the mechanism of denunciation, because it had such a powerful effect in removing people from society, it began to be used in all sorts of different ways. Wives who were fed up of their husbands would denounce them, and vice versa. People who envied their neighbour's apartment would denounce them to see if they could get their hands on it from a corrupt housing official. People who had workplace disagreements or resented a colleague could denounce them. And it didn't take any production of proof or evidence on the part of a denouncer, only the actual denunciation itself. The first exclusion of society of former people happened in 1918, when the Constitution of the Russian Republic was drawn up. It excluded from elections to the Soviets persons using hired labour with the aim of extracting profit, so anyone who is a, quote, for want of a better word, capitalist. This covers kulaks, as well as urban entrepreneurs and artisans. Persons living off unearned income, so anybody with private wealth or capital, dividends from capital, profits from enterprises, rent from property and so forth. It excluded private traders and middlemen, monks and priests of all denominations, former employees and agents of the Tsarist police, secret police and special corps of gendarmes. Members of the former imperial family, the House of Romanov. So anyone who really didn't earn their living through some kind of labour was excluded. The disenfranchised individuals formed the kind of like the nucleus of a bigger group of people who of enemy classes and people from particular social backgrounds who were added to later on throughout the 20s and 30s. And they were known collectively as alien elements or social aliens. And the wider group included former nobles, the former bourgeoisie, former Tsarist bureaucrats, anybody whom had the word former by their name came under the kind of the umbrella of former people. There's a great book by Douglas Smith, Former People, which charts the kind of the horrific fate of Russia's aristocracy through the revolution and the virtual extinction of Russia's upper classes by the time of the late Stalin era. Now, even if there was a list drawn up by central government of disenfranchised classes, I beg your pardon, the overall reach of those who were disenfranchised grew wider as local Soviets also drew up lists of local individuals and social groups who were to be disenfranchised. And eventually, the judgment came down to those who simply looked like class enemies. So it becomes incredibly flexible as to who is disenfranchised and why. Now, initially, this is a significant problem in the lives of Soviet citizens, but it's not quite life-threatening. However, during the period of the Great Terror, it is. Because, as I mentioned earlier, the people who, say, in the 1920s or early 1930s had been designated as a class enemy, they would have a very difficult time finding work. They would be disenfranchised from any Soviet elections, and they would find it very difficult to find housing. But they're on a list, and the list is dangerous. The list is the first thing that the three Manchuikas will go through when deciding on executions during the Great Terror. And the list is also kind of viral, in that when people on the list are arrested and interrogated, the first thing that is asked is, who else do you know? Who else is in your network? The assumption being that the class enemies and traitors were all conspiring together against the state. So to this end, if anybody was denounced or even accused of being a class enemy, there was a scrabble to disavow them, to be as far away from them as possible, and to imply that one had never been friends with them in the first place. During the 1920s, in a kind of rather brutal attempt to even society out, to limit the life chances of the former bourgeoisie, and to promote the life chances of the working classes, universities and schools, housing authorities, rationing boards were able to practice social selection. So if you're working class, you're more likely to get into university, into a college, into a school. If you're working class, you're more likely to get somewhere to live. If you're working class, you're more likely to get something to eat. And if you're working class, if you're part of the bourgeoisie, not only would all these things not be tilted in your favour, but also you'd be subjected to higher taxes. The courts were supposed to follow the principles of class justice by punishing social aliens harshly and showing leniency to proletarians. Social aliens were barred from joining the Communist Party, obviously, and the Komsomol, and often from employment in government offices. This meant that disenfranchised social aliens were deprived not only of the right to vote, but also of a host of other opportunities and rights and the possibility of advancing themselves in any way. The suspicion on the part of the party is that these canny bourgeois types would take any opportunity handed to them and use it simply to start accumulating capital, to start having wealth, storing it, investing it, and quickly becoming part of the newly emergent capitalist system. The party, for its thinkers, its intellectuals, saw class as a very complicated set of ideas that couldn't simply reduce to origins. The party as a whole believed that a genealogy of class was logical and fitting and made sense, and that being able to look at somebody's family history and suggest, well, if your father had been a noble or a kulak before the revolution, that you too would share that stigma, because you will obviously have inherited the values of your parents, even irrespective of what your political convictions are now. And this would be irrespective of whatever you kind of had to say about the revolution, no matter how much you denounced it. So we'll continue with a bit more of that later in the week. But one of the key takeaway points here, I suppose, is that for Stalin, class warfare and terror was kind of a numbers game. Stalin was pretty open about the idea that if 100 innocent individuals were caught, imprisoned or executed, and one guilty man was caught with them, then that had been a success, and that it was better to do that than allow the guilty man to get away. The guilty individual being obviously an individual who did not agree with the verdict of October 1917. And it's that kind of logic that fuels not just the era of class persecution in the 20s and 30s, but also the period of the Great Terror. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.